from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's nearly 300 years since Gulliver's Travels was first published. In all those years, it's never been out of print. Its targets of absurd war, mindless oppression, and human meanness would still attract Jonathan Swift's scathing satire. In A Modest Proposal, a fierce protest against hunger and poverty in Ireland, Swift's ironic advocacy of cannibalism remains deeply disturbing. This hour On Point, a new biography takes us into the life and world and worldview of Jonathan Swift, master satirist of human failing and absurdity. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you get it when you first read Gulliver's Travels? Did you have the stomach to finish A Modest Proposal? What might Jonathan Swift skewer now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Gulliver's Travels, never out of print. People always reading, and of course, in the 20th century and later, not just between the covers of books, movies as well, one after another on Gulliver's Travels. Here's a little bit where Gulliver is captured by the Lilliputians. He's eager to find out why they are at war. Gulliver, played here by Ted Danson in the 1996 TV miniseries, asks the Emperor of Lilliput, played by Peter O'Toole, about their enemy.
Forgive my ignorance, Excellency, but who are Big Enders, and why are they your sworn enemy?
Well, because... Boys, explain!
Yes, of course. It's very simple. We are Little Enders, and the enemy are Big Enders.
But what does Big Enders or Little Enders mean?
There's a subversive tone to his questioning that I don't care for.
I agree. Are you an agitator?
Certainly not.
Well, about Swift, I don't know. Maybe so. Joining me now in the studio, Leo Damrosch, professor of literature at Harvard, author of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Restless Genius, and Tocqueville's Discovery of America. His latest, Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World, last week won the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography. Leo Damrosch, congratulations and welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you right here, and what a wonderful biography to read. This is a man of parts, if there ever was one, in Ireland, in England, all kinds of relationships that I did not know about. You write about in great depth. Just take us back to those two works that are most well-known, if you would, for a moment, and first to Gulliver's Travels. At what point in his life did he write it, and what was it that he was looking to say to the big wide world, at least his world?
He was in middle age by the time he wrote it. It was the most ambitious book he ever wrote, and he put a lot of care into it. It took 4 years to finish. He actually loved to read books of travels, and although it's meant as a parody of, you know, preposterous claims by travelers, it actually works as a fantasy novel. So although he saw it as a satire on politics at the time, we could talk about that later on if you want. Most of that goes over the heads of modern readers. And the book lives because, in fact, it's just an unforgettable creation of an imaginary world.
And a world in which human foibles are sent up in such preposterous and wonderful ways. We can't get enough of it.
Yeah, the name Gulliver suggests gullible, and he's always proudly describing how things are done back home in Europe to the shock and horror of his listeners.
Gulliver, as I recall, one of the names that he used himself sometimes to write under. He wrote anonymously or under pseudonyms.
Yes, Swift never signed his name to his own works, partly because he really saw himself as a public figure in politics and religion more than as a writer, but also because many of his works were quite subversive. And not only would he publish them anonymously, but have somebody else write them out in their handwriting and have them secretly delivered in the nighttime to a printer who could never swear who they came from.
This makes us really want to know the world that he lived in, if it took all that skullduggery to get them printed without putting himself at risk. And then there's A Modest Proposal. And of course, it's got a longer title than that. But here it takes us to Ireland, to poverty, to hunger, and his proposal. Well, describe it. Remind us.
Yeah. He was born in Ireland, but of English parents, and thought of himself as an Englishman and claimed to despise Ireland. But the more his career got stalled in England, the more he began identifying with his native country. And in fact, it's been said more than anyone before him, he gave his country a national consciousness, not just Catholic or Protestant, but Irish.
His country in this case, meaning Ireland.
Meaning Ireland. But all through the 1720s, which was a time of terrible economic depression, England continued to exploit Ireland just as a colony, just like Jamaica or Massachusetts at the time. And it felt it was part of the United Kingdom and ought to be treated like an equal. Swift tried proposal after proposal that were perfectly serious for ways they could defend themselves against English oppression. And he felt like the Irish people were selling out, that they were betraying their own nation. So A Modest Proposal is a very bitter account of how they might as well just start eating babies as the only solution to poverty.
Now, even today, reading it, it can take your breath away. There are points where I thought, oh, can we say that on the air? But of course, when they did 300 years ago, you've got a passage I wonder if you might read for us from A Modest Proposal. Let's go to that one. To just give a sense of how explicit and potentially disturbing this was.
Yeah, it's a deadpan parody of what an economist might say, totally pragmatic, has no idea what he's saying is outrageous.
About eating our own children.
And just briefly I'll mention Peter O'Toole, who we just heard, was invited to speak at an opening of a new theater in Dublin in the 1980s, and he began reading this without telling what it was, and people started heckling and walking out because they were so shocked.
Too much.
Yeah. So I'll read a bit of it.
Jonathan Swift, from nearly 300 years ago, 1729, A Modest Proposal.
A child will make two dishes at an entertainment for friends, and when the family dines alone, the fore or hindquarter will make a reasonable dish, seasoned with a little salt and pepper, will be very good boiled on the fourth day. I recommend buying the children alive and dressing them hot from the knife as we do roasting pigs. I grant this food will be somewhat dear, therefore very proper for landlords, who, as they have already devoured most of the parents, seem to have the best title to the children. I've computed the charge of nursing a beggar's child, which I reckon all cottagers, laborers, and four-fifths of the farmers, to be about 2 shillings per annum, rags included. And I believe no gentleman would repine to give 10 shillings for the carcass of a good fat child. Thus the squire will learn to be a good landlord and grow popular among his tenants. The mother will have 8 shillings net profit and be fit for work till she produces another child. And those who are more thrifty may flay the carcass, the skin of which will make admirable gloves for ladies and summer boots for gentlemen. As for the elderly, I'm not in the least pain upon that matter, because it's very well known they are every day dying and rotting by cold and famine and filth and vermin as fast as can be reasonably expected.
It still takes the breath away. Jonathan Swift's a little bit there from A Modest Proposal. Leo Damrosch reads for us. His new biography is Jonathan Swift, His Life and World. Just won the 2013 National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. It's just incredible to hear that even now. Was Jonathan Swift thin-skinned, or was his outrage in proportion to the moral scandals of his day?
Well, I think it was absolutely appropriate. The treatment of Ireland was and remained unconscionable a century later. The appalling potato famine could have been averted if the British would have allowed the Irish to eat the grain they themselves were growing, but they were supposed to live on potatoes and give all the grain to the landlord. So it was a purely economic decision to destroy the Irish people. Swift is very well aware of that kind of thing. But in addition, I think like every great satirist, he's not a mocker. He's a disillusioned idealist. He's appalled that human beings treat each other so badly. Mark Twain was very much like him.
Yeah, that brought Twain to mind, that passage just read.
Yeah, there's a wonderful remark of Twain's. He said, I don't care if a person is a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian. So long as he's a human being, that's all I need to know. He couldn't be worse.
I had never read Swift's biography. I had no idea he was a clergyman. Was this moral outrage grounded in a religious view of the world?
I would say ethical. He was not a very spiritual person. His private faith is hard to tell about. He was certainly not a hypocrite.
But even though he was trained as a cleric, served at one?
Well, in those days it was a profession, and indeed it was inseparable from politics. The church, through parish outreach and so on, did many things that a government would now do. And he always expected to be made a bishop, and bishops sat in the House of Lords and voted in the British Parliament.
So he never got higher than administering the St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, but he aspired higher.
He aspired higher, but unfortunately, the political party he was working for, and indeed as a PR man, crashed and burned. It turned out to have been flirting with the pretender, the exiled James III, if he had ever got his throne back.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, because the party in power appointed bishops, there was no chance that he ever would get one.
We associate this sort of tone of high moral dudgeon about poverty and hunger with a liberal position today. But he was not a liberal. He was, in terms of his time, a Tory conservative.
Yeah, but they were all conservative. The Whigs were just as conservative. They were the party of expanding the British Empire, which Swift was bitterly opposed to. He hated slavery. He hated imperialism.
Which not everybody did. Robinson Crusoe's Defoe was not against
slavery. Yeah, Defoe was all in favor of it. In Robinson Crusoe, after he's shipwrecked on the desert island and finds God, he realizes God was sending him a message. He should not have gone in a ship to bring Negroes back to his plantation. He should have sent somebody else to get the Negroes.
That was Defoe. That was not Jonathan Swift, of
right,
course.
Right.
He of a unbelievable high sort of moral satire on humans, the human condition, in Gulliver's Travels, in A Modest Proposal, and much more. Leo Damrosch writes up his life and times. We'll dive into them when we come back. The new book is Jonathan Swift. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the life and biting satire of Jonathan Swift, author of Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal that we become cannibals, or at least the Irish, of his time in poverty and hunger. Leo Damrosch joins me. He's professor of literature at Harvard University, author of the new biography, Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography, and it is quite a story. Leo Damrosch joins me in the studio, and I want to dive into that life, but we've just got wonderful questions here from our listeners. Here's one from Joe, who writes to us on our website. He says, it's said that George Orwell, in his essay Shooting the Elephant, most admired Swift among few others, but disagreed with Swift on almost all moral positions. I wonder if Swift is too subtle and acidic for the general democratic citizen of the internet to appreciate, Joe asks. What about Orwell and Swift?
Well, Orwell was a committed socialist, though, as we know, anti-communist. And he felt that Swift sided with the privileged old order, and that's not untrue. It would be hard to find an 18th century socialist. One of the things Orwell says is he's afraid Swift doesn't think the common people are any better than their rulers. And that's true. He didn't think they were any worse either. He didn't think any human beings amounted to much. So, in fact, Orwell could not resist Swift's passionate commitment to justice. And he once said he would preserve Gulliver's Travels as one of six books if all others would be destroyed.
Take us on the thread through his life that, in your view, after all of your study here, brought him to this disillusionment with humanity, to this deeply satirical view of the world. Where do you find that thread? The I don't know, the people or events or encounters, or maybe it was just born in him? How did he come to that view of the world?
Well, maybe to some extent it was his temperament, but his life was one long series of frustrations and disappointments, and the image we all probably have of Gulliver waking up on the beach and finding himself pinned to the ground by tiny people with hundreds of threads is like a symbol of Swift's life.
Take us through some of those threads.
Yeah. His father died just before he was born, and indeed there's circumstantial evidence to suggest that was not his biological father at
evidence
all.
Evidence that Swift would have been aware of?
Very probably at one time in his life he at least suspected it or maybe even became sure of it. And that would have been a problem for several relationships that he had. His life was very complicated. He was brought up by an uncle. He said the uncle gave him the education of a dog. He, in fact, was sent to the best school in Ireland and then to Trinity College.
It was pretty kind treatment from looking at it from the outside.
My guess is there was a subsidy from whoever the real father was, and the uncle was grudgingly—
passing it on.
Yeah, administering it.
Meeting it out. Mm-hmm.
His mother, at least the story that Swift was told, left Ireland just after his birth and went home to Leicester in England, leaving him with the in-laws. He didn't probably see her again until he was 21 years old, but supposedly his wet nurse, because she loved him so much, abducted him to a different place in England, and he spent his first 3 years with her, after which the Swift family finally brought him back. He was then put in a boarding school. It's like he belonged nowhere. He didn't really know who he was. Mm-hmm. He was constantly betrayed and, you know, left behind. And when he became a graduate of the college and was seeking work, he found employment with a distinguished retired diplomat who wanted a secretary, but who had no idea he had a genius working for him. Mm-hmm. The diplomat thought he was a world-class writer. So Swift spent 10 years on very low wages doing kind of stenography for this self-important old bore.
Temple,
his name was, Sir William Temple. So when he finally got into the public scene in his 30s and began working for the Tory government.
And pretty high in the public scene.
Yeah, they valued him because he was so smart, and he was a great writer, great political writer. But still, he was a front man, a mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. He was not a player in his own right. And his belief was they would reward him with that bishopric that he wanted. And instead, the best they could do just before they fell from power was to get him the deanship of St. Patrick's back in Dublin, which he saw as exile. So by then, he'd felt like he'd suffered a lot very unjustly.
And he would never be a bishop. His love life, you pay a lot of attention to, and it's very complicated and obscure, ambiguous, even to his contemporaries.
Yeah, he was a man of secrets, and 300 years later, it's pretty hard to expose secrets that someone really wanted to keep. The older biographers of Swift used to just put it under the carpet and say, we can't prove anything, so it's not worth knowing. But it certainly was worth knowing for him. When he got to Sir William Temple's place in
this was his country
estate. House in England, there was a 9-year-old girl, the housekeeper's daughter, very smart, who Swift was invited to tutor. It's not
he would have been 20-something.
20, 21 or 22. Mm-hmm. Not clear why a servant's girl should have a distinguished tutor, let alone why when Sir William died she should get a bequest worth £1,000 where the other servants got £20.
A significant
She was almost then. Certainly his illegitimate daughter, Sir William's. Mm-hmm. And there's very, very good evidence for that I go through in the book.
So here's Swift tutoring her. She's much younger. She's a girl.
Yeah, by the time she's an adult, she's become his dearest friend, moved to Ireland when he went back there. They were apparently, though, never together without a third party present. Even so, some of their very closest friends thought they were secretly married. But then why would it have to be a secret? And one hypothesis, which I've already hinted at, is he found out to his horror that he was the half-brother of Sir William Temple. This would take a little too long to explain.
All right.
He would then be the uncle of this Esther Johnson, whom he nicknamed Stella. Mm-hmm. They could then not legally be married, or indeed within the rules of the church.
But he was deeply enchanted.
But he was very, very, very close to her, although he called it violent friendship. He felt it was not the swept away kind of falling in love. And that happened with a much younger woman, 20 years younger. Her name was also Esther. He calls her Vanessa.
How old was Swift when he was smitten with this, Vanessa?
He was in his early 40s, and she was 19 when he met her. She was very beautiful and very, very intelligent.
This was the daughter of a Dutch family who'd come through Ireland to London.
Yeah, the Dutch merchant had died, and his widow had come to London with her children, having inherited quite a lot of money to live there. And she was absolutely, passionately in love with Swift for his brains, for his charm. And they almost certainly had a sexual relationship, but it was so carefully concealed that even recent biographers have tried to pretend it never happened.
They described it in your telling in code in their exchanges of letters. They called it coffee.
Coffee. He, of course, thought the letters would all be destroyed, and he destroyed his side of the correspondence. But Vanessa had kept drafts of her letters.
Need coffee once a week or I can't write.
Yeah, exactly. I have a couple of quotes here if you want them.
No, that's okay. I think we got the idea.
Yeah. There's no coffee worth drinking but yours.
Yeah.
So she kept drafts of her letters, and she kept his letters to her. And even so, her executors destroyed half of the letters. It probably were too flagrant. But the ones that survived show she was an honorable person, just so deeply in love that she was willing to hang in there and hope one day he might marry her.
Did he write? Did he see his relationships with these women somehow marking him as an outlier, a social outlaw, I don't know. Do they relate somehow to his view of the world? Or this is just a different realm.
No, it's a very good question, except he was in every respect secretive. And these would be the biggest secrets in his life. But he told tall stories about himself. He's a lot like Twain that way, too. But whereas Twain had a deeply committed marriage, Swift was, I think, afraid of marriage. It was entrapping himself. He preferred these relationships more at arm's length.
He's a wonderful character as you bring him to life. Most men of his station would have ridden in carriages. He loved a physical life. He traveled on horseback. He'd have a servant following, maybe two, with baggage, but he'd have the exercise of the horse, not just the carriage.
Yeah, and it's one reason that intelligent horses are important in Gulliver's travels. He loved horses. He understood them well.
Leo Damrosch writes the life and times of Jonathan Swift in his new biography, Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World. Leo, let's begin to bring our listeners in, if we may. From New Orleans, John is calling. John, you're on the air with Leo Damrosch.
Gentlemen, how are you all today?
Very well. What do you think, John?
Well, you mentioned what brought me to Jonathan Swift. As a child, of course, I read the unabridged version of Gulliver's. When I was in college, I had a professor who fancied Swift and read to us one day Peter and Canisius. If you know that poem, and I won't get to the end of it, it has quite a humorous and shocking ending. And then, of course, he read us afterwards A Modest Proposal. And from there, I kind of really became enamored of Swift and read some of his about his life. And as it turns out, he and I share a similar affliction. A loud ringing of the ears. There's a name for it, which I've forgotten.
It's Meniere's syndrome.
Meniere's syndrome.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I have it, and he has it. So anyway, he's endeared himself to me through his writing and us sharing the same affliction. And I love him greatly as a writer. I think he's amazing. Satirist and a very important writer.
You and many feeling that love, John. I appreciate your call. He had a number of health afflictions in his life, this foremost, maybe.
Yeah, I got a case of shingles and so on, but this was an undiagnosable condition at the time. It's something wrong with the inner ear, but it has different symptoms that seem to come from different sources. There would be this dizziness. There would be the terrible ringing in the ears. There would be nausea. At times, the vertigo was so bad, he would have to lie on the floor so he wouldn't fall down.
It could make you impatient with everything, including humanity, I would think.
Yeah, and maybe distrustful of the body itself, which is letting you down all your life.
Yeah, yeah. John in Foxborough, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? How you doing, Leo? I'm halfway through the book, and I'm greatly enjoying it. I wanted to ask about, I know Swift was a clergyman, and I wanted to get a sense of what his sermons were like, and I'll take my answer off the air.
I wonder the same. Thank you, John. You describe him as something of a skeptic, and yet here he was. It was his job to deal with congregations, at least at some points in his life. What about sermonizing? Did he do it?
Yeah, he did it well. He would preach every fifth Sunday at St. Patrick's, and there was always a big congregation to hear him. He had no interest in theology and doctrine.
So what did he talk about?
So he thought the church was there to give people moral encouragement and, to be a basis for an ethical community. And that was what his sermons would be about. He didn't even care much about the sermons. He threw most of them away. The ones that survived, there's a dozen or so, are only because one of his best friends, who was also a preacher, said, I'll use them if you don't want to. They're not brilliant pieces of work, and they weren't meant to be. He wanted them to be perfectly easy to understand for an ordinary congregation.
And he was very clear about that. That's the target. That was his goal, not to write for intellectuals, but to write. And so you remind, he would read his work to I don't know, the stablemen to see if they got it, and then he'd reach the right distillation.
Absolutely, and his rules for good prose are exactly like George Orwell's. Never use a long word if a short one would do. Don't use foreign words if you don't have to. Never use a cliche you've heard before. Make it as clear and cogent as you can, and that's one reason he's still so readable.
When did he begin to develop this capacity? How did he come to understand that he had this wonderful talent for very biting satire? Or did he see it that way as it emerged?
Oh, I think so. I mean, he had a very big chip on his shoulder, but he also apparently was a very gifted mimic socially. He loved to impersonate, and he would just do it for fun. So it came naturally to him to pretend to be a blindly smug economist or a member of the party that he actually hated, or an old lady, a servant woman who's suddenly lost her purse, just taking
inhabiting
on,
that view.
Yeah, kind of ventriloquism. It gave him pleasure in itself. And so in a way, it let him sometimes be transgressive because these made-up voices would say things that he might not openly say.
I mean, he's saying things here that George Carlin might have said in his comedy centuries later and still were found outrageous. Bill in Hartford, Connecticut. You're on with Leo Damrosch. Bill, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I just wanted to comment that, like, Bach and Handel were born in the same year, and two musical geniuses, and then Brian Wilson and Paul McCartney many years later. It strikes me as amazing that Jonathan Swift and Voltaire wrote it around the same time. And these two geniuses that looked at the world that they were living in and pointed out the craziness and absurdity of it. And, of course, Voltaire's answer was to tend your own garden, acknowledge it's all crazy out there, do what you can to deal with it, but acknowledge that and try to make your own life. And, it was, you know, he was writing about wars that had been happening for thousands of years, and here we are today with what's going on in Crimea, the same thing. I mean, it's a universal thing that seems to be forever. And these two geniuses noticing this at around the same time, and it's as relevant today as it ever was.
Oh, Bill, thank you. Leo.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They both are masters of irony, very, very witty. Although I actually say in the book, it's very rare for the same person to have wit and humor. And Voltaire had wit but not humor. Mm-hmm. Dickens had humor but not wit. And Swift really does have both, although in his angriest satires it doesn't come out. But in fact, it's been said, cultivate your garden, but the whole of Europe was Voltaire's garden because he was a passionate reformer, exposing abuses all over Europe. Likewise, Ireland is Swift's garden, so it doesn't just mean drop out.
Swift, you remind us, was alive during a time of revolutionary change. A king was deposed, sensational revolution. The modern political system came into being. The British Empire began its growth. Was the scale of those political dramas key to the scale of his ambition and his satire?
Yeah, I think so. He's very well aware the world is changing fast, and he's not so much reactionary as just shocked at the way it seems to be going, which is more and more greed and exploitation of power. The caller mentioned Voltaire's outrage. In his case, it was the Seven Years' War. There was a war for much of Swift's early adult life called the War of the Spanish Succession, which is a boring old name today. But what it implied was France might actually get control of Spain and become the world's superpower. Mm-hmm. So British
could army— could not happen to the British, the Londoners.
Yeah, so under the Duke of Marlborough, this war was being fought against France. But Swift thought the war was being fought for its own sake, for England's advantage, not just to stop Louis XIV, and he thought it was an evil war and wrote against it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and biting satire of Jonathan Swift, author of Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal and more. Leo Damrosch joins me. He's professor of literature at Harvard University, author of the new biography, Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award in biography. Many ways to go here. Let's just get a little more sense of him and his longest relationship, I guess, love, perhaps marriage, perhaps Stella. He wrote a birthday poem for her, I wonder if you might set it up, tell us about it, and read something more of Swift.
Yeah, he used
it's not from Gulliver's Travels and all that.
Yeah, he used to write a poem on her birthday every year. And he had developed a very colloquial, conversational, easygoing style. It rhymes, but otherwise it could be actual speech. And they're charming poems because there's so much obvious affection in them. I'll just read a short one. Mm-hmm. He was 54 at this point. She's 38, but he pretends not to know how old she is. They're both putting on weight and well aware of that. Yeah. It begins like this. Stella this day is 34. We won't dispute a year or more. However, Stella, be not troubled, although thy size and years are doubled, since first I saw thee at 16, the brightest virgin of the green, so little as thy form declined, made up so largely in thy mind. Oh, would it please the gods to split thy beauty, size, and years and wit? No age could furnish out a pair of nymphs so graceful, wise, and fair, with half the luster of your eyes, with half thy wit, thy years, and size.
Yeah, oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful.
And then I thought maybe I'd read just a short excerpt from actually his best poem. As people aren't aware what a good poet he was. It's called Verses on the Death of Dr. Swift, and he's imagining the gossip when he's gone. He refers to the vertigo, although in those days they pronounced it vertigo. That's okay. The mania syndrome that a caller mentioned sharing with Swift. He was also painfully aware of short-term memory lapses, and indeed it was the opening symptoms of the dementia that eventually made him completely helpless. So there's really sad self-knowledge in the conversation he imagines when he's gone. Yet thus methinks I hear him spake, it was an Irish accent,
yes.
See how the dean begins to break. Poor gentleman, he droops apace, you plainly find it in his face. That old vertigo in his head will never leave him till he's dead. Besides, his memory decays, he recollects not what he says. He cannot call his friends to mind, forgets the place where last he dined. Plies you with stories o'er and o'er, he told them 50 times before. How does he fancy we can sit to hear his out-of-fashioned wit? But he takes up with younger folks who, for his wine, will bear his jokes.
Imagining the conversation after his own death, I always wonder with a great satirist like this, and the same question goes to my mind with Twain and others, how they dealt with themselves and whether they were as cutting with themselves, if he was as cutting with himself and his own foibles as he was with the world.
I think he absolutely was, and he was given to what they would have called melancholy, which is real depressive episodes, and of course the ill health made that so much worse. And he once said, when he's still a very young man, I have to have my mind engaged in something all the time. And the implication was it just starts freewheeling out of control if he's not focused on some task.
He was so secretive, always writing under another name or anonymously, had a series of pen names that he used. What was at risk? What was the political context, if indeed it was politics, or the risk of political something coming down on his head? What might that have been?
Well, because he was on the wrong side politically and because he was suspected, probably unjustly, of actually having colluded with the power that wanted to overthrow the government. They were always looking to get him, and also because he was mobilizing Irish resistance, and they just regarded him as a big threat that way. So what he would do is have his writings copied out by someone else, delivered secretly. Gulliver's Travels, he had the first of the four books of Gulliver's Travels delivered in the dead of night to an obscure printer in London with whom he'd never had any relationship, with a cover letter purporting to be by an actual old sailor man saying, these are the memoirs of a friend of mine, and if you think you'd like them, someone will come back a week from now and have £200 ready. And the publisher said he didn't have that much cash, but he'd love to take it on if they would give him a little time.
And, of course, it was a great success so quickly.
It was an unbelievable success. In those days, there were no royalties, so all the profit would go to the publisher.
And then printed very soon after in, I think, France and Germany.
Printed everywhere. But I think the printer never knew for a long time who the author was.
Would there have been particular admirals or generals or ministers of state who would have felt personally mocked in Gulliver's Travels?
Oh, sure. And the prime minister was a very powerful person named Sir Robert Walpole. Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of Lyndon Johnson. He knew everybody's, price. And he definitely was out to get Swift. And he's satirized in Gulliver's Travels. And in a way, it's an advantage for that book, that the satire has to be indirect and cautious.
Yes.
Because we can still read it and say, this is what politicians are always like.
Made it more universal that he had to be on wary of being too particular.
Exactly.
Wow. Take us to Swift and Ireland, because he had such a difficult relationship with Ireland, and yet he became known as such an Irish patriot in his own terms.
Well, what happened was, when he first went back to Ireland, he kept his head down for 6 or 8 years, didn't publish anything, then began to think it was probably safe now. There was a, in itself, kind of absurd controversy, but he made it symbolically important. A private citizen who had bribed a mistress of King George had been given the right to coin copper money for Ireland, and he was coining colossal amounts of it, and it was pretty clearly debased. And in those days, money had to be worth the metal in it. So you could use, you know, French coins or German. It was all the same. So he was going to destroy the Irish economy. And
for his personal gain.
Yeah, for his personal gain. And Swift was able to highlight this abuse as typical of the way England was treating Ireland. And he became a national hero because suddenly people could focus on a cause that they all shared. It didn't matter whether you were a Catholic peasant or, you know, a nobleman. And so every year on his birthday, there would be bonfires and church bells ringing. Pubs were named after him.
But it wasn't easy getting to that point, and it was a testy relationship sometimes too. John in Buffalo, New York is calling. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was curious about Swift's attitude and views regarding the native Irish population at that time, particularly the Irish Catholic population. And I was curious as to what his views in regards to the British Empire in regard to the island.
Yeah, two questions, although they're related, because, of course, Ireland was treated as one of many colonies, even though it happened to be next door. And whereas Massachusetts could not be, you know, micromanaged because it took months to get there and back. It was all too easy to do that in Dublin. He was very sympathetic to the Irish peasants, as they would call them then, the cottagers. Their poverty was appalling. He knew it was largely due to exploitation by landlords and middlemen who were skimming all the money. Many of them were illiterate, but he found that those who could speak English spoke wonderfully well. They were witty and interesting and charming. He preferred them to English farmers. So he was really on their side.
On their side, but he wrote very cuttingly about Ireland and the Irish too.
That was really the ruling class of Ireland.
Okay.
They were the so-called ascendancy was the 15% who were Anglicans. They were the only ones who could go to the university, hold judgeships, be elected to parliament. They ran the entire country. They were his people, but he felt like they were betraying their trust.
Meredith in Bolton Landing, New York. Meredith, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In line with how the English were treating people, remember Malthusian economic theory, which in a nutshell says, starve your working class, pay them only enough so that all but the strongest die, and that way they won't breed like rabbits and overwhelm you, and you'll get a hardier working stock by abusing them. It kind of goes along with the with Swift's point. And one more point, I also recall when I was introduced to it in maybe even grade school, to Gulliver's Travel, what I took away from it was, watch out for little people because they can gang up and take you down.
Great points both, Meredith. What about the economic thinking of the time, just how brutal it could be? And I don't know, would Swift have seen his Lilliputians as these forerunners of the rising proletariat or something else?
No, I don't think they were the proletariat, but and Malthus was a couple of generations later, but Swift certainly foresees the way that kind of theorizing is going to go.
Yes.
As for the Lilliputians, I think the idea is they're petty. They're tiny miniature versions of ourselves. So the idea that they squabble over trivial little distinctions and go to war over nothing, you played that little thing about big Indians and little Indians. The idea was which end of the egg you break decides, it's an allegory of religious controversy, We're going to kill all the big Indians because we're little Indians. Mm-hmm. And in the end, if you look at the Lilliputian Bible, it says you should break whichever end is convenient. Yeah. So in fact, it's because the Lilliputians are tiny that they show us how petty we are. Mm.
Gabriel in New Orleans, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes.
Gabriel,
hello,
yes.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to make the point that I remember very clearly being introduced to Modest Proposal 20 years ago. And it's interesting to me, its influence on my thinking about argumentation, political and cultural satire, obviously. But one of your broader questions about, you know, we're still living with these concepts and his influence, and I would say absolutely. I remember the Stephen Colbert press club dinner with George W. Bush, and I remember thinking, wow, a Modest Proposal.
Yeah, Gabriel, that's great. What about his heirs in our current environment? You cite Twain from a century back. What about now? What do you see Swift's heirs?
I think Colbert is a perfect example because, whereas John Stewart, whom I greatly admire, is kind of ingratiating. He wants to be liked. Colbert is really putting on an act and pretending to be the opposite of what he really thinks, and that's exactly what Swift would have done. And the Modest Proposal has struck so many people with that kind of power. There's a recent memoir by the chef Eddie Wong called Fresh Off the Boat, very engrossing book. He was in college in Florida and read A Modest Proposal, and it blew him away that you could do this in writing. He said to himself, dogs, you can win this game.
Yeah, so go. So many know these two so well, Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal. What about his other works? What would you point us to understand the fullness of Swift?
Well, they're all dated in a way that those are not, and that's not to say they weren't wonderful or important at the time. He wrote to the particular moment. He was trying to influence events, usually. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't for the ages. But he did have one piece, another short satire that's very effective. It's called An Argument Against Abolishing Christianity. And it pretends that there is a bill pending in Parliament to get rid of the Christian religion. And his argument in this piece is there's no reason to do that because all we have is nominal Christianity. It doesn't affect anyone's life. And we hear that in the early days of the church, it actually had something to do with people's behavior. But since that never happens anymore, let's not waste any time abolishing it.
Why be bothered? Very sad scenes from late in his life. He was losing or had lost his mind. And I think it's in your that I read his own caretakers kind of paraded him in the street.
Not in the street, but they would let visitors come in and pay for the privilege of seeing him.
Sort of in his undoneness.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote his own epitaph.
Yeah, it's in Latin, but Yeats translated it beautifully. It's actually now on the wall in St. Patrick's Cathedral.
You've translated it too, offer a translation.
But mine is literal, so you can tell what the Latin is. But Yeats's was, he is gone where savage indignation can lacerate his heart no more.
He is gone where savage indignation can lacerate his heart no more. There's a fellow Irishman with sympathy for what it took to carry that satire.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas he had a friend named John Gay who wrote the hit musical, The Beggar's Opera. Gay wrote an epitaph for himself, which is on the wall in Westminster Abbey. Life is a jest and all things show it. I thought so once and now I know it.
Set Jonathan Swift down in 2014, it would be what they call a target-rich environment.
Yeah, absolutely. He would think nothing has changed.
Period.
Yeah, I mean, he would attack new targets, but in exactly the same way.
What do you think would be first as he wielded his pen around? Where would he be looking? What would he see? What would show up on the Swift screen?
Well, he would be amazed that we don't have an established church. It wouldn't have had to be the Church of England and Ireland. He understood that in Italy it would be the Catholic Church. He thought that was the glue that holds society together. So the fragment.
Even though he wasn't so religious, he thought there was an ethical glue there.
Yeah, absolutely. So he would be shocked at the, you know, not just
diminution.
That kind of central authority. Of course, he'd be amazed by democracy, and it's hard to think that he would have welcomed it.
Because
he thought the people who own the land ought to be the power in the country because they have its interests at heart. And, you know, the merchants who are simply getting as rich as possible, he thought, were the enemy of
So that made him an admirer of the aristocracy.
Yeah, although most aristocrats he thought were imbeciles. And he said, if you ever find a good-looking, intelligent aristocrat, he's probably the coachman's son.
So where did he find somewhere beyond these two very important women in his life to settle with ease, with admiration?
He was actually very good at friendship. He had a wide circle of friends. He was playful.
Literary
and
friends.
Enjoyable. Oh, just fellow clergymen, all kinds of people. Some of his servants were dear friends. In fact, he was not the misanthrope that he's often thought to be, because that's a pose in his writing.
Wow. And I don't know, give us a line or two that you share when you want to get across the essence or another face of Swift that we might miss.
Oh, I don't know. There's another passage in one of his poems. 'Tis an old maxim in the schools that flattery's the food of fools, but now and then your men of wit will condescend to take a bit.
Wow, it is wonderful from first to last. And if I may flatter, you tell it very well. Leo Damrosch, what a pleasure to have you in to bring Jonathan Swift back to us.
Just my pleasure,
wonderful.
Tom. Thank you so much.
Just wonderful. Leo Damrosch, author of Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World. Last week, it won the 2013 National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. It's a great read. Swift's work woven throughout, and Leo Damrosch is all around. Just wonderful, Leo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point. Thank you.